This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents This is the Year I Put My Financial Life in Order by John Schwartz. Read for you by Kaleo Griffith. Introduction. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, 19 and 6. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, 0 and 6. Result, misery. Charles Dickens, David Copperfield. I am an idiot. That, at least, is the impression I get from personal finance websites and magazines and books. They all seem to say I'm doing pretty much everything wrong when it comes to my financial life. Basically, because I don't pay that much attention to my finances. As a journalist, I understand that telling people to doubt themselves is part of the game of newsstand sales, and in the digital age, page views. That's why "You're Doing It Wrong" is such powerful clickbait. None of us spends much time on a website that affirms our choices and tells us we are in good shape. No parenting magazine could last long if it didn't suggest that its advice will make a world of difference. This is especially true when it comes to advice about parenting. Our 7-step plan will help you raise a future Ivy Leaguer. Ignore us, and you will end up with a basement-dwelling angry loner who spends his days playing online games and staring dully at porn. It's much the same persuasion game when it comes to financial advice. The person giving the advice has to start from the position that you'll go broke without this help. In publishing, sex may sell, but insecurity sells even better. In my case, they could be right about my being all wrong. I mean, look at me. I had reached my mid-50s and didn't have a will. How dumb is that? I had no idea whether the life insurance that I got through my employer was enough to support my family if I got squashed by a bus during my morning run. And I hadn't given any thought to figuring out whether the money I'd been putting away for retirement had been well invested and would lead my wife, Jean, and me to comfort or misery. Living in the now may be great Zen wisdom, but it's a lousy way to go about planning for retirement. We all know we need to do these things, to balance our portfolios, to get a will, to make sure our life insurance policies are generous enough to take care of our loved ones if we meet up with that aforementioned bus. Still, we procrastinate, or we don't know what we should do. We're supposed to buy low and sell high. Or is it buy and hold? We're supposed to spring into action and refinance our mortgages the moment interest rates drop below, what was that rule of thumb again? We're supposed to pay down all our loans, except maybe for the loans that have really low rates. Or is it the smallest loans first? And in the middle of all that, we're supposed to finance the kids' college educations and deal adroitly with expensive family emergencies. So, over the last year, Jean and I embarked on a project. We took a hard look at what a rather heedless financial existence has left undone. I tried to educate myself about the world of finance and investing. Then, with the help of books, friends, and a few professionals, we worked to get our financial life in order. This book is the story of how we got here, what we did, and what we learned along the way. I realized it was time to get our financial house in order, not because I'm near retirement, I hope not, but because this reckoning was overdue. We were surely starting later than we should have, but without a time machine, starting now was as good as it was going to get. Better late than, you know. Our financial life has not been a straightforward march toward prosperity. We have struggled. For much of our adult lives, Jean and I have lived paycheck to paycheck, and we have veered close to financial disaster more times than I'd like to remember. Our late 30s were a nightmare. Jean and I lived through a crisis that started when we moved from New York City to Washington, D.C., so that I could take a great job. But a New York real estate slump kept us from being able to sell our apartment, and deadbeat tenants drove us nearly to bankruptcy. We lost the New York place, and the resulting squeeze kept things tight for years after that. How tight? When I was working at the Washington Post, on the days before payday, my lunch order in the company cafeteria was often French fries with gravy. The mess of carbs, salt, and fat cost less than $2, and that filling meal kept me going until I could get home for dinner. And I knew that one solid knock from illness or a layoff could have transformed our financial life from tight to devastated. That didn't happen, thank goodness. But the ups and downs continued. Things would let up for a while, and the squeeze would set in again. About a year after I'd gotten to the New York Times, an editor predicted that, financially speaking, I was going to crash and burn. He wasn't my boss, but we both worked for the business section of the paper and had gotten to be friendly. We often rode the same train into the city from Maplewood, New Jersey, and back again. "I know what you make," he said, "and I don't see how you're going to make it." He edited personal finance stories and had planned out his own retirement beautifully. He had built up a generous cushion in his retirement plan and could count on a good pension as well. He lived frugally, driving a beat-up Ford Fiesta that got more than 40 miles per gallon. In the year or so before he retired, he had built a house on Cape Cod and planned to keep up a little freelance editing work for additional income. This cobbler's children did not go barefoot. It was clear from our conversation, however, that he didn't understand how Gene and I survived from paycheck to paycheck, much less saved for the future. And he was hinting at something even worse. He didn't think we were going to make it. At all. And you know what? He wasn't wrong. We were in trouble. Despite our best efforts to stay within our means, we were spending more than we were making, and our debts were once again adding up. Result? Misery. So, I might seem like the last person in the world you'd want to take financial advice from. After all, we had made bad decisions, and they put us in a hole. It was very hard to climb out. But we did climb out. How did we do it? Some of it was luck. Some of it was good choices we made in our 20s. Some of it was, in our confusion and fear, finding people who knew much more than we did and following their advice. And some of it was learning new things and acting on that hard-earned wisdom. You have probably made some bad decisions as well. But you can climb out too. You can find your guides. You can make your own luck. Sid Richardson, the legendary Texas oil man, liked to say, "I'd rather be lucky than smart." In his business, he had seen booms and busts, enriched wildcatters and humbled titans. He knew that it wasn't necessarily the smartest who thrived. Of course, Richardson was aw-shucksing a little. He had enjoyed a share of luck, but he was also damned smart. That resonates with me. A large portion of my good fortune has been getting jobs and keeping them at companies that had old-fashioned pension plans. I've also made some of my luck. Keeping those jobs is no small trick. And anyone with sense knows that you can improve your situation through preparation and hard work. If you succeed, good fortune is always part of the picture. Yet fortune favors the prepared mind, as Louis Pasteur is supposed to have said. So this story is also not just about us. Gene and I aren't that interesting. Yes, it involves our experiences and also the process of exploration I've gone through in trying to understand and fix our financial situation. That information becomes, for you, the listener, a sort of guide to the financial world and planning for retirement. What I taught myself also turns out to be what you might need to know. What are the foundations of a good retirement account? What the heck is an exchange-traded fund? Should you ever go to one of those free dinners that retirement consultants send invitations for in the mail? And why does money make so many of us so very, very crazy? The things Gene and I did over the course of the year to take charge of our financial life, figuring out life insurance, drawing up our wills, and the rest, I've written up in a way that will show you how it's done. That's the part where my being a reporter, someone who can take complicated information and make sense of it for readers and listeners, comes in handy. So this is not your standard personal finance guide. It's more of a hybrid, If you would rather be reading one of those other kinds of financial books on financial planning or getting rich by 40, your local bookstore has long, heavy shelves of them. Many are written by people who have real financial expertise, or at least talk a good game. Let me admit that I find most of those books impenetrable, teachy, and preachy. Worse, too many of them suffer from their author's need to dress up what is, generally, a short list of common-sense investing ideas with gobbledygook and big promises. This book, by contrast, keeps the advice simple, throws away the cloak of mystery, and blends in our story in ways that we hope can be useful, without whining. I wrote This Is the Year for people like us, a little money-phobic maybe, but willing to learn before it's too late. There are a lot of us out there. While more than half of Americans fret about whether they will have enough money for retirement, just 39% have ever tried to figure out how much they will need, according to the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, Investor Education Foundation, an organization that tracks our money sense. So if we're idiots, we're not alone. Many people don't save enough for retirement, or don't save at all. According to a report by the National Institute on Retirement Security, some 45% of working-age households have no retirement account assets, while the overall national median retirement account balance is just $2,500. As the Institute put it, the average U.S. working-age household has virtually no retirement savings. And that's preparing for the future. Many of us can't even handle the present. A 2016 report from the Federal Reserve found that 46% of Americans couldn't cover an emergency expense of $400 without borrowing the money, which includes putting it on a credit card, or selling something. Ideally, anyone listening to this book might want to look at what we did and decide to do the smart things, only better and earlier. I hope that people younger than us will take the lessons directed at them to heart and end up not having to eat as many lunches of fries and gravy, or whatever affordable staple millennials eat. Quinoa? Okay, quinoa. Quinoa is apparently a seed and not a grain. That's everything I know about quinoa. The idea that became this book started with a piece I wrote for the New York Times about retirement planning. It walked readers through our efforts to figure out where we stood with regard to our financial endgame, how much we'd have to live on once we retired. The process of writing, I figured, would help me get over my money phobia. After all, I tackle tough topics all the time in the course of my work, especially in my science journalism, so I thought, why not make it an assignment? If it's part of my job to learn about my finances, I'm likelier to get over the hump and figure things out. That led me to pitch the story. I would have a deadline, an obligation to an editor. And, because special sections are considered freelance work at the Times, I'd get paid. All that would provide me with the incentive I'd previously lacked. This is the way my mind works. I won't defend it. The story described my own nervousness when it comes to thinking about finances. The response from readers was surprising. Apparently, there are many, many people out there who share my anxiety. One colleague called it frighteningly familiar, and my inbox became a digital confessional for readers who found themselves, uncomfortably, in the same boat. Other readers offered advice. Buy more bonds. Buy fewer bonds. Go jump in a lake. One helpful fellow told me that the answer was to buy a house in a small town in rural France. He had done this, and things were going great for him. I congratulated him. I write back to almost everyone who isn't really insulting. That story got passed around. A neighbor, a great guy in his 30s with a couple of kids, told me his father sent him a 3x5 index card, his usual epistolary medium, lauding the piece. Take it to heart, he wrote. Before you know it, you were looking at your ability to keep paying for things during the second half of your life. The neighbor, Brian, noted in an email to me, I have to say, this is one of the longer written notes I have received from my father in the past several years, or maybe ever. Had we struck a chord? Could we be the wake-up call for other people whether in their 50s or 30s, or just about any age this side of retirement? How could we purport to be teachers after having done so many things wrong? I was drawn to the idea that we might be useful fools, teaching by good choices and by our flawed example. This is not a unique idea. We all learn from failure as well as success. As poor Jude Fawley, the epic loser of Hardy's Jude the Obscure, put it, "I may do some good before I am dead, be a sort of success as a frightful example of what not to do, and so illustrate a moral story." Our disasters are good for something, if we know enough not to let them go to waste. This book opens with that first step in the project to get our financial lives in order, taking a hard look at our progress toward funding our retirement. The other chapters present broader areas of personal finance that most of us face: saving for kids' college, buying and selling homes, dealing with a medical disaster, bankruptcy, debt, getting insurance, and writing a will, along with the experiences that Jean and I have had, for better or worse, in facing them. So hello, listener. Welcome to the secrets of our failures, and yes, our successes. Jean and I, in telling our story, are trying to walk a line here between self-revelation and self-flagellation. I won't call the story a journey, because the word is overused. But what a long, strange trip it's been. If we entertain you, that's great. If you get something useful out of it, even better. And if our story at times gives you a soul-warming rush of schadenfreude, we don't mind one bit. Chapter 1. The Project. This project began with my realization that it was time to finally figure out whether we were going to be comfortable in retirement or miserable. Going into it, I knew that we were pretty fortunate compared with many Americans. As I've said, I have always worked for companies that pay reasonably well and that provide pensions. Those pensions have been fully funded, at least within the legal definition. Those companies have also sponsored retirement plans for employees and encouraged them to build 401k accounts with matching contributions, and I have done that. Also, I've been able to hold on to jobs over the years in a business that's seen plenty of layoffs. Our household budgets have been tight, but aside from that ill-fated apartment purchase in our 30s, our family hasn't suffered the kind of financial setback or catastrophic illness that destroy many a family's nest egg. We knew we had something tucked away, but was that something enough? Thanks to the recent sale of a house we had lived in for 15 years, we had some financial breathing room, at least for a while. But I had no idea where we stood in terms of being able to retire someday. I'd all but stopped looking at the envelopes from Vanguard after 2007, when my funds lost about 40% of their value. Not an outrageous dip in the context of the broader economic crisis and recession, but a searing one for me. As a sometime financial reporter, I knew enough not to sell stocks during a sell-off, so I didn't compound the damage with a panic sale. Besides, I've always found it easy not to do anything. Sloth comes naturally to me. I figured that the accounts had bounced back to some extent, but hadn't been tracking them closely. And I had no idea how long such funds would last once I stopped getting a paycheck. A gnawing feeling in my gut convinced me at last that this was the year to get our finances together. Maybe past time, if the numbers didn't come out right. And while I hope to have good years of productive work ahead, I also have to think about retirement and plan for it, to look at whether I'm on the right track and to begin addressing some of the other issues that I'd been avoiding all these years. Where to start? With an industry built around retirement planning, I was faced with the paralysis of too much choice and too little knowledge. How do I find a retirement consultant? Those who work on commission might be tempted to sell financial products that increase their incomes, not mine. And those who charge a flat fee might try to keep things quick and easy for them, to ensure that their time is efficiently used. I had no intention of being a quick hit on somebody's conveyor belt. As it happens, The 401k accounts I built up at the three publications I have worked for over the last 30 years are all under the same roof. The mutual funds giant, Vanguard. That promised to make things relatively easy, and the company offers free counseling from a certified financial planner to clients of employer-sponsored plans who are over 55. So, one evening in January, I made the call to Vanguard's 800 number. After navigating the voice command system, I ended up talking to an upbeat guy named Jeff, who told me that I could either set up an appointment for a phone session with one of their certified financial planners, or I could get a more thorough counseling session by, first, filling out an online questionnaire that would give the planner a more holistic view of my financial picture before our conversation. The result, he said, would be a personalized financial plan. Filling out the document takes about 45 minutes, he said. As I hung up, Jean, sitting across the living room on the couch, asked, "Any luck?" I told her about the 45-minute questionnaire and said, "We can fill it out together." "Thrilling," she said. The very first question stumped me. It asked the age I planned to retire. Well, see, this is part of the problem. That is precisely the kind of question I've been avoiding all these years. Jean and I had never discussed it. I love my job. Journalism is a career that calls for hard work, but it rarely feels like work. So we were starting with a big, big question. Jean has worked part-time for years, so her decision would have less impact on our retirement picture. We knew that Social Security has traditionally kicked in at 62, but that you could earn more if you hold out longer, say, until 66. Medicare begins at 65. And after hunting around online, it appeared that sticking with gainful employment until 70 would lead to the biggest Social Security benefit. Jean, a pragmatist, noted ominously, "Your retirement isn't under your control entirely. My employer has a lot to say about it. But we could project a best case and decided that sticking it out to 70 would be the likeliest course to set us up in terms of our investments, Social Security, and pensions. Besides, even if I got booted out of one job, I could probably still find a way to keep earning. Many of my friends at the Times had moved on to fulfilling careers on the outside. 70 it would be. Okay, so we had an answer. Success." "So that was question number one?" Jean asked. "Yes," I said. She laughed. "That was more than 45 minutes. Okay, it was going to be a long night. The first answer had taken so long that the Vanguard website had logged me out for inactivity. I went back in, entered the answer, and soon came to an ever more difficult question. "How long do you expect to live?" "Well, holy guacamole, let me check my appointment book." We had moved abruptly from economics to metaphysics, or at least actuarial science. Here, too, however, we decided to plan for a good outcome while understanding that the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune could make best estimates meaningless. Our four parents were still going strong in their 80s and 90s. My father, at 91, was still working as a lobbyist in the 2016 session of the Texas legislature. He'd laugh at the idea of quitting at 70. So we again filled in some rather optimistic estimates and then marched on through questions that were pretty obviously intended to measure my tolerance for investment risk. Whether I was likely to sell stocks in a market downturn? No. Whether I would invest in a fund based on a casual conversation or tip? Heck no. And such like. Then came another stumper. What percentage of our income would we hope to receive in retirement? Searching through financial websites, I found that many people look for about 70 or 80% of their working income in retirement. The assumption is that retirees will live less expensively than they did in their more active years. So, once again, I plugged in yet another guess, based on yet another rule of thumb that I hadn't known moments before. As Jean and I discussed these things, I realized we had never really talked about whatever passed for my investment strategy. I offered to describe mine such as it is. but she cut me off, saying, "My strategy is not to know your strategy." I was gratified by her level of trust in me, but wondered whether it was justified, and whether she was just trying to shut me up. Still, I did my best to express my amorphous thoughts on investing. I explained that I'd been skeptical of financial advice programs about hardcore investing by gurus like Jim Cramer. I never felt that I was the kind of guy who could beat the market. That's how I came up with my laissez-faire approach. I had a hard time remembering how much of my income I had assigned to the funds 14 years before when I came to the Times. After doing some research, I discovered that it was 10%, the same portion of my income I'd maintained during my years at Newsweek and the Washington Post. Jean said, "I approve," which, after more than 40 years together, is nice to hear. Proceeding through the questionnaire, I then had to track down what we could expect to receive from Social Security each month at age 70, a pretty easy figure to find from SSA.gov, and what my various pensions might bring in. That process could not be handled from my easy chair, as I had to ask former employers to come up with estimates. One would answer during the course of a single phone call. The other took weeks to calculate an estimate and send it by mail. Anticipating a slog, I decided I'd had enough for the night. When I shut my laptop, 4 hours had passed from the time I had started the survey, and I was far from done. But we were thinking about the right questions at last. The next day, Jean sent me an email mentioning a conversation she'd had with a coworker who had asked a quality of life question. If you wait until you are 70 to retire, you might get a bigger payout. But will you be in any condition to enjoy it? I responded, "An excellent question. If 70 is the new 50, yes. If 70 is the old 70, no." Our parents, as I said, had been very young 70-year-olds. It seemed like a safe bet. But I decided to ask the counselor to look at the numbers under a couple of different retirement ages. Over the next few days, I gathered the final bits of information about what my pensions from various employers would amount to and finished the form. Soon after that, Vanguard came back with a report generated from my answers. It said I should be more heavily invested in bonds. Considering my age, the report stated, I had too much money in stocks. Vanguard's quarterly mailings had been telling me that for a while, so this advice was no surprise. But then, I saw words that seemed to levitate off the page. You're on track to meet your retirement goals. It was a beautiful thing. If we continued the way we were going, if the financial markets didn't collapse, if the magical fairies that govern employment and health were good to us, we would make it. I was, frankly, surprised. Jean was exultant. She said, "We won't be eating cat food." But of course, there were uncertainties. The document from Vanguard presented three scenarios for my portfolio over time based on past U.S. market performance: best, average, and worst. The worst-case scenario left us with $800,000, well below what we'd need for a comfortable drawdown from our 401k in retirement. The best case was ridiculously high, nearly $4 million. The average scenario put us at about $2 million, which should make for a comfortable retirement. But which will it be? There's no way to tell. It's still a game of if. A week later, I had the conversation with the financial advisor, an upbeat guy named Greg. We discussed how to get on what he somewhat ominously called the glide path to a more balanced portfolio for retirement. He explained that the allocation between stocks and bonds mentioned in the report was actually a big deal. The most important one you make as an investor. Even bigger than deciding what funds we invest in, since bonds help cushion your investments against stock market drops. When things are bad, your drops are not as extreme, so your recovery doesn't have to be as extreme, he said. I didn't have a lot of my money in bonds. The recommended percentage at my age, and considering my aptitude for risk from the questions I'd answered, was about 35% in bonds and 65% in stocks. I told him that I'd take a hard look at shifting the balance toward more bonds. He also wanted to talk about some of the mutual funds I've been invested in since starting to save 30 years before, and noted that several of them were funds run by fund managers, and based on research in the markets, with higher rates than I would pay if I put more of my assets into so-called index funds, which are based on market indexes like the Standard & Poor's 500. While much of my portfolio was already in such an index fund, he explained that I could make more money by putting more of my assets into lower-fee index funds. The report from Vanguard had recommended a number of index funds the company offers that focus on large companies, mid-size companies, and international companies. It all went by pretty fast, but I caught most of it. He didn't push me on any of these proposed changes. He told me that I could shift the assets myself, when I was ready, from my home computer. The report that Vanguard had generated recommended some of those funds, and I could use those or find others, he said. Most important, changing funds within Vanguard would cost me nothing. No asset transfer fees, he said. Sweet. He also explained what we could expect if I wanted to shorten my time working and retire in my 60s. His estimates put us a little closer to the margins. Less travel, buying cheaper cuts of meat. But he suggested that our current portfolio could, barring ill fortune, deliver us to comfort, if not prosperity. It felt good to be done. But we weren't, of course. This was only the beginning. We plugged a bunch of hypothetical numbers into a model and got a nice picture back. Much was still left to chance. Every decision led to others, and opening one door led to even more doors. I would have to make decisions about whether to buy more bonds and whether to move more of our assets into index funds. And beyond our retirement planning, we still had so much to do to be able to say we'd gotten our financial life in order. We still did not have a will. I still needed to look at my level of life insurance to make sure the family would be covered if that bus found me. And there were things like medical directives. If either of us became incapacitated, under what circumstances would we want someone to pull the plug? And then what to do with our potentially useful organs? And more and more. Answering the next questions wasn't going to give us control over the future either, but it might offer a buffer against misfortune. The project wasn't over. But then, nothing ever is. Until everything is. Punch list. Now it's your turn to take a look at yourself. If you're like us, you've been putting off assessing your retirement plans. It's time to figure out what assets you have and where you're likely to end up financially. Take the first step. 1. Open the envelope. If you have a retirement plan, whether a 401k provided by your employer or an individual retirement account, IRA, rip open the damned envelope, or if you have more than one plan, envelopes, and take a look. You can also check it out online. You'll find more information on that after you actually open the envelope. 2. Check your pension. If you're vested for any pension income, find out what to expect by contacting the employers you should have a pension with. 3. Have a talk with Uncle Sam. Find out what kind of Social Security income to expect. Go to ssa.gov/myaccount to see where you stand. If you don't have an account yet, it's easy to sign up for one, and it will provide your employment records going back, well, forever. The $135 I earned in the summer of 1968 as an 11-year-old page in the Texas House of Representatives was there. 4. Add up the rest. Tote up your other assets, including the value of your home and any other investments you might have picked up along the way. 5. Get the picture. As a preliminary check, we'll be talking more about how to structure a portfolio at any age and finding good financial advisors in a while. Plug your figures into any of a number of good retirement calculators out there. You can find them at the websites of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, Fidelity, Vanguard, Schwab, Bankrate, and the AARP, for starters. This will take longer than 45 minutes. But, like us, once you've gone through the process, you will have gotten a start on figuring out your financial future. Interlude. Why money makes us crazy. What is it that makes money so hard to deal with and to think about? When my commuting buddy, the editor with the good retirement plan, told me that he expected me to go down in flames, he was comparing the cost of living in our area of New Jersey with what he knew we were earning. He figured that we were spending more than we made. Financial journalism was his trade, and he had us pegged for losers. There's a journalism cliche, almost a verbal tic, that you might have noticed in your years of reading the news. A writer starts the story with an example of a person in distress because, say, he is going through a harrowing experience with the healthcare system or airline baggage fees, or dealing with frustrating automated telephone menus, or, well, just about anything. End paragraph. The next paragraph begins, "He is not alone." Then begins the part of the story that explains that this is, in fact, a surprisingly common problem, with statistics to back up the thesis. If no such statistics exist, you'll see some version of the hoary, "Statistics are hard to come by, but," and some reference to experts saying that they see the troubling trend of people being frustrated by baggage fees or automated telephone menus more and more frequently. So, here goes. We are not alone. Half of Americans either break even or spend more than they make, according to the 2016 National Financial Capabilities Study from FINRA, which collects statistics like these. Statistics are, in fact, pretty easy to come by on topics like this. About 20% of people admit to spending more than they earn. I also assume that many of the rest of these people are lying. Only 20%? Come on! In 2012, 26% of those surveyed said they had overdue medical bills. In the improved economy and health insurance market of 2015, that percentage was down to 21%. About a third of Americans found themselves paying the minimum on credit card balances instead of paying off their cards each month. That's down from 40% in 2009. In 2015, 34% of those surveyed said they either probably or definitely could not come up with $2,000 within a month if a sudden need arose. Another 23% said they probably could come up with the money, and probably gave that answer nervously. If you're not already well off, in other words, it's likely that you are feeling squeezed and certainly at some financial risk. A different report from the Federal Reserve in 2016 found that 31% of Americans, about 76 million people, were either struggling to get by or just getting by. The fact that 56% of people in the survey, taken in 2015, said they were living comfortably or doing okay was good news. This was the report I mentioned earlier, the one with a startling statistic that 46% of Americans couldn't even cover an emergency expense of $400 without borrowing the money or selling something. They had that little ready money. We've all seen this financial fragility around us. Friends or family members who have hit hard times, and the rise of stores with names like Dollar Tree and Dollar General. Jean saw the credit crunch firsthand during the year she worked at our local Target store. Customers would get to her checkout line and pull out a wallet stuffed with credit cards. The first would be rejected, so the customer would fish out a second. Rejected. This would go on until a piece of plastic could be found that wasn't over its limit. The sum of all those debts was enormous. Jean and I didn't end up with a wallet full of burning credit cards, but life still has a way of messing with your best intentions. And money makes us crazy. I don't mean that poverty makes us crazy. Poverty makes us miserable. I'm talking about the ways that people think about money, fret about it, pursue it, and lose it, and wonder why everybody else seems to have more of it than we do. Why has it taken Jean and me so long even to take a hard look at our finances? My excuse is simple. Numbers scare me. As a reporter, I can be motivated to learn what I need to know in order to cover numbers in science, business, and other topics. I study up, I talk to experts, and I produce skull sweat until I understand what I'm writing about. If I don't, somebody will fire me. Incentive. For the most part, however, I put off thinking about retirement and largely kept out of my own business. In this, again, I am not alone. Scientists who study math anxiety say that the anticipation of crunching numbers can lead to the kind of agitation that, on a brain scan, looks a lot like the perception of physical pain. One study by Sean Bylock, a University of Chicago professor of psychology, said that the brain reaction can be similar to that produced by burning one's hand on a hot stove. We've been there. Math isn't my only problem. I'm uncomfortable thinking about money. And let's face it, the future scares me silly. Actually, I find it difficult to make choices of any kind. I agonize over buying a new pair of boots or a coffee maker. My opinion shifts endlessly, and then after the purchase, I suffer buyer's remorse in a way that exasperates Jean. That fear of money is probably part of the reason so few people save for retirement. According to the American Psychological Association's Stress in America survey, money is the top source of stress in our lives. Nearly three-quarters of Americans reported feeling stressed about money in the previous month, with higher levels of anxiety for the younger generations and those living in low-income households, according to the survey, which is conducted for the APA by the Harris Poll. So what is it about money that puts us under all that stress, besides simply not having enough? This is a question that Lindsay Goldwert, a journalist and stand-up comic, asks in her money-oriented podcast, Spent, in a way that is both profane and profound. Why are we so fucked up about money? It's a big, important question, however you ask it. I decided to seek out some experts. You may not know this, but there is actually a thing known as financial therapy. Some of the practitioners are therapists who find that many of their clients need to talk about money, and so they specialize. Others have training in both therapy and financial planning and advice. Here's a revelation that probably will not shock you. Money is one of the things that can drive couples apart. It is a point of conflict that is both difficult to talk about and hard to fix. Joan D. Atwood, a marriage and family therapist in Rockville Center, New York, has written that speaking about money in marriage is the last taboo. Couples would prefer to talk about sex or infidelities rather than how they handle family finances or how much money they earn. I called her, and she told me that money is not a happy thing for most people. In fact, it's really a metaphor for feelings of being loved and cared for. Among her patients, she said, if they're getting money, they feel cared for and happy. If they are not getting money, they are feeling deprived and unhappy, she said. It's the meaning of money that just triggers deep-seated whatevers in people. As a therapist, she said, she sees every kind of conflict, and money is often at the bottom of things. There are different types of couples and different ways that they handle money, and very often, it's a metaphor for the way they manage their relationship. Young couples might come to the marriage with separate finances, but older couples tend to have much more complicated and intertwined financial relationships, she said. Remarried families with the rivalries and jealousies and financial intrigue are especially challenging. Many of us, she told me, unknowingly see money as a surrogate for love. Metaphors abound. Is your husband, your father, your mother, your wife, giving enough, withholding too much? We are all called to account. With this much going on, resentments can run deep. After talking with Atwood, I wanted to know more about financial therapy. So I checked in with an organization called the Financial Therapy Association. Their members have training in various blends of disciplines that include marriage therapy, family therapy, and social work, but also financial counseling. Christy Arcoletta, an associate professor in the Department of Family Studies and Human Services at Kansas State University, is a co-founder of the group. The members have different skills, she said, but they work at understanding behavior, emotions, relations, and how all of those aspects impact money, and how money impacts all of those aspects. This can be a very effective mix, she explained. She told me about a conventional therapist who asked for her help with a troubled undergraduate. The student hoped to enroll in graduate school, but had a poor credit rating and was deeply anxious about whether he would be able to get a college loan. The therapist had been working with the student on techniques to handle anxiety and attain a calmer state, but nothing was helping. The therapist then brought in a colleague who was a financial planner. The planner explained that the student's credit score should not affect his ability to get a federal student loan, short of problems like foreclosure or bankruptcy. The reason for the anxiety went away. The problem was cured, Arcoletta said. In her own practice, she says, she does a good deal of premarital counseling to ensure that a couple's views on money are compatible and to work through ways to communicate and handle conflict and the many ups and downs of marriage. You can't handle money without having addressed those other issues, she said. Among married couples, not only is it one of the most fought-about topics, it's fought about differently, she said. It's fought about in ways that make it more intense than other arguments. Agreeing with Atwood, she said that it's an emotionally charged topic that hits deep inside of people. People react to it. The fact that they argue about money can actually be a sign that there's something much deeper going on in the relationship, she said. Since people don't like to talk about money, the tensions fester, she said, so that by the time she sees them, the conflict has been going on for a long time. It's almost at that point become a habit. It's how they interact with each other. That makes it hard for the couple to reflect on how they got to this point of intense conflict. And worse, they don't know another way to deal with it. Secrecy and lack of trust are big parts of money conflicts. Arcoletta told me that she has encountered couples on the verge of bankruptcy, but one spouse had no clue because the other spouse had taken out secret charge cards and concealed bills. As I was talking with Arcoletta, I remembered a friend who divorced her husband after discovering that he had emptied their bank accounts through his compulsive visits to topless bars. Another friend, after getting married, discovered that her husband had not paid taxes for years. She was a responsible person, and that was one of her first clues, that her husband saw money issues fundamentally incompatibly. She is much happier with her second husband. So how does anyone come back from a betrayal like that? I asked. Arcoletta told me about the techniques she uses to help couples regain the trust they once had, and the stability and security. The couples she has worked with have been able to bridge that gap. But it wasn't until after a lot of time working through grief, she said. They had to learn to communicate differently, and to understand what money meant to them and what their goals were for each other. But wait, I thought, aren't those the same techniques a therapist would use to help people get past an extramarital affair? You are exactly right, she said. It would be very similar, but with a difference of degree. In her experience, it would be easier to talk about them having an affair with someone else than to talk about financial infidelity. Money occupies such a big part of our consciousness that it's only natural that it would be tied into our neuroses. Norm Foreman, a psychologist who has studied our fraught relationship with our bank accounts and assets, developed techniques to determine the degree of what he calls people's money sanity. He came up with a questionnaire that he included in his book, Mind Over Money, published in 1987. The book is little known today, but it lays out a pretty cool way to look at the issue. In it, Forman identifies five types of people with money neuroses. He calls them the miser, spendthrift, tycoon, bargain hunter, and gambler. The misers obsess over gathering money and hoarding it, but don't seem to enjoy having it. They fear losing their money and trust no one. Dickens' curmudgeonly Ebenezer Scrooge from A Christmas Carol is one of literature's great misers, though Noddy Boffin of Our Mutual Friend gives him a run for his money. However, Boffin's case is more complicated than it initially seems. Then comes the spendthrift, who can't help throwing money around, especially when feeling worthless or depressed. Novelist Don DeLillo captured that experience in his epic novel of consumerism, White Noise. His narrator, the pompous professor and pioneering Hitler scholar, Jack Gladney, has a peak shopping experience after a distressing social encounter with another faculty member, who tells him that outside his campus domain, Jack looks harmless. Jack meets up with his family at the mall and finds himself compelled to spend. I shopped with reckless abandon. I shopped for immediate needs and distant contingencies. I shopped for its own sake, looking and touching, inspecting merchandise I had no intention of buying, then buying it. The effect is like a powerful drug. I began to grow in value and self-regard. I filled myself out, found new aspects of myself, located a person I'd forgotten existed. Brightness settled around me. In real life, however, Forman spendthrifts find that the thrill fades quickly. What's left is often guilt and an empty bank account. The third Forman neurotic, the tycoon, is all about the Benjamins, baby. Making money is, for the tycoon, a path to power and influence and to absolute control over his environment. The fourth type, the bargain hunter, is fulfilled only when spending less for goods than the next guy. Nothing angers or depresses him as much as paying retail. The haggling and coupon clipping are compulsive. Finally, Forman's last money neurotic, the gambler, gets off on risk itself and on the adrenaline rush of winning. Forman's categories are eerily familiar. It's uncanny to see how well he captured the ways that neuroses play out. But taken too literally, they are also a little narrow. Pigeonholes for behavior that is often complex and blended. What if I'm a spendthrift gambler? I'm not. I'm more of a bargain hunter with occasional bouts of reckless spending, or something. Still, some of his descriptions resonate within the broader psychological literature. Some recognition of a compulsive shopping disorder, for example, has been part of medical literature for more than 100 years, and even has a cool Greek name, oneomania. Psychiatric authorities debate whether it should be considered a subset of addictive behavior or something more like obsessive-compulsive behavior, while others argue that the need to classify our problems as diseases, medicalizing unwise behavior, is itself a bad trend. Compulsive shopping is not part of the current Bible of the psychiatric field, the DSM-5. The most recent edition also left out compulsive buying and other addiction-like behaviors such as compulsive sex and kleptomania. The guide, however, does include compulsive gambling, Forman's fifth money neurosis, within its set of substance-related and addictive disorders such as drug abuse. Go figure. The field is developing, and arguments over the psychology of money will continue. Maybe we should think of it this way. Money might not make us all crazy, but it can be one way that we focus and express our craziness. For my last stop on my tour of our mental money trauma, I called Adrian Furnham, a psychologist and professor at University College London. He worked with Forman and has written an updated version, The New Psychology of Money. Furnham told me that he took up the field because he and his supervisor were both interested in subjects that psychology forgot. Money, they decided, fit the bill. It was everywhere and was a favorite topic in pop psychology. But most books on the subject were written by therapists The subject had not been deeply explored as a subject for rigorous empirical research. Money, then, was like water in David Foster Wallace's famous joke from his 2005 commencement speech at Kenyon College. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys. How's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" Money issues, Furnham said, had already come into his life as a student. "I had a girlfriend who was a great spender, and I was a great saver. They were divided," he said, "by what I saw as her utter irrationality with money and what she saw as my utter irrationality with regard to money. The relationship did not last. I'm very happy to say I'm married to a woman who exactly matches my money beliefs and behaviors. We've never had an argument about money," he said. "I was a lucky boy." That brought us around to discussing a study he did comparing attitudes of men and women when it comes to money. He and colleagues gave the Foreman Money Sanity Questionnaire to more than 100,000 subjects, most of them British. They found notable differences. For men, more than women, money represented power and security. Men were more likely to be hoarders, while women did more emotional regulatory purchasing, which they referred to as retail therapy. Men, they wrote, were likelier to take risks with money when investing, while, compared to males, females were worried spenders. They shopped as a form of therapy, and they worried more about money. Overall, females exhibited a higher money insanity score. What he found, he said, is that men see money instrumentally. They see it as a way of getting what they want, to influence others. Women see it more emotionally, as an expression of love. I suggested that seemed like the language of stereotype, not science, but he repeated that this was derived from the Foreman questionnaires, not preconceptions. The findings weren't strong, but they went in the right direction, he said. I wasn't fully convinced. It seems to me that men and women have come far enough in terms of gender equity to be equally neurotic. But his findings might help explain why money can be such an enormous source of stress for couples. With these insights, the explanation grew clearer. Suddenly, I was seeing the problem from 30,000 feet. Money makes us crazy because it's important, and not just because of food and mortgages. It's important because it runs deep, way below the conscious level. It runs so deep that it connects with some of our most primal feelings and strongest fears, except for spiders. Money is also one of the strongest defenses we employ against an unquiet mind, the bit of Jack Gladney within us all. Our buying sprees and accumulated wealth become proxies for love, balm for the distance of faded friends, a crutch to prop up our inadequate supplies of serotonin. Buying ourselves a treat lifts us. Having money can comfort us. We use money, whether we know it or not, as a defense against the existential terror that is baked into all our lives, that one piece of knowledge that is uniquely human. Someday, we all will die. Whoa, that got dark fast. Still, no less true. Chapter 2. Starting Out. Today, too many families operate uncomfortably close to the financial edge. And, like everything else, that fact has become politicized. Many conservatives like to blame people in financial trouble for causing their problems, and accuse them of profligacy and overspending. Others look beyond moralistic sensibilities and see built-in problems in rising costs for housing, health insurance, transportation, taxes, and child care. Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi tackled the question of why so many people are under financial strain in an article published in 2005, well before the Great Recession, when things got even worse. The article, What's Hurting the Middle Class, stated that covering the basics of family life, things that have to be paid whether or not someone loses a job or gets sick, and which they call the nut, has gotten much more expensive than it used to be.